3. Supernatural Aid. For those who have not refused the call, the first encounter of the hero journey is with a protective figure, often a little old crone or old man, who provides the adventurer with amulets against the dragon forces he is about to pass. An East African tribe, for example, the Wachaga of Tanganyika, tell of a very poor man named Kayazimba, who set out in desperation for the land where the sun rises. And he had traveled long and grown tired, and was simply standing, looking hopelessly in the direction of his search, when he heard someone approaching from behind. He turned and perceived a decrepit little woman. She came up and wished to know his business. When he had told her, she wrapped her garment around him and, soaring from the earth, transported him to the zenith, where the sun pauses in the middle of the day. Then, with a mighty din, a great company of men came from eastward to that place, and in the midst of them was a brilliant chieftain, who, when he had arrived, slaughtered an ox and sat down to feast with his retainers. The old woman asked his help for Kayazimba. The chieftain blessed the man and sent him home. And it is recorded that he lived in prosperity ever after. Among the American Indians of the Southwest, the favorite personage in this benignant role is Spider Woman, a grandmotherly little dame who lives underground. The twin war gods of the Navajo, on the way to the house of their father, the Sun, had hardly departed from their home following a holy trail, when they came upon this wonderful little figure.
The boys traveled rapidly in the holy trail, and soon after sunrise, near Tzilnaotil, saw smoke arising from the ground. They went to the place where the smoke rose, and they found it came from the smoke hole of a subterranean chamber. A ladder, black from smoke, projected through the hole. Looking down into the chamber, they saw an old woman, the Spider Woman, who glanced up at them and said, "Welcome, children. Enter. Who are you? And whence do you come together walking?" They made no answer, but descended the ladder. When they reached the floor, she again spoke to them, asking, "Whither do you two go walking together?" "Nowhere in particular," they answered. "We came here because we had nowhere else to go." She asked this question 4 times, and each time she received a similar answer. Then she said, "Perhaps you would seek your father?" "Yes," they answered, "if we only knew the way to his dwelling." "Ah," said the woman, "it is a long and dangerous way to the house of your father, the Sun. There are many monsters dwelling between here and there, and perhaps, when you get there, your father may not be glad to see you, and may punish you for coming. You must pass 4 places of danger: the rocks that crush the traveler, the reeds that cut him to pieces, the cane cactuses that tear him to pieces, and the boiling sands that overwhelm him. But I shall give you something to subdue your enemies and preserve your lives." She gave them a charm called Feather of the Alien Gods, which consisted of a hoop with 2 life feathers, feathers plucked from a living eagle, attached, and another life feather to preserve their existence. She taught them also this magic formula, which, if repeated to their enemies, would subdue their anger: "Put your feet down with pollen, put your hands down with pollen, put your head down with pollen. Then your feet are pollen, your hands are pollen, your body is pollen, your mind is pollen, your voice is pollen. The trail is beautiful. Be still."
Pollen is a symbol of spiritual energy among the American Indians of the Southwest. It is used profusely in all ceremonials, both to drive evil away and to mark out the symbolical path of life. The helpful crone and fairy godmother is a familiar feature of European fairy lore. In Christian saints' legends, the role is commonly played by the Virgin. The Virgin, by her intercession, can win the mercy of the Father. Spider-Woman, with her web, can control the movements of the Son. The hero who has come under the protection of the Cosmic Mother cannot be harmed. The threat of Ariadne brought Theseus safely through the adventure of the labyrinth. This is the guiding power that runs through the work of Dante, in the female figures of Beatrice and the Virgin, and appears in Goethe's Faust successively as Gretchen, Helen of Troy, and the Virgin. "Thou art the living fount of hope," prays Dante at the end of his safe passage through the perils of the three worlds. "Lady, thou art so great and so availest that whoso would have grace and has not recourse to thee would have his desire fly without wings. Thy benignity not only succors him who asks, but oftentimes freely foreruns the asking. In thee, mercy, in thee, pity, in thee, magnificence, in thee, whatever of goodness is in any creature, are united." What such a figure represents is the benign, protecting power of destiny. The fantasy is a reassurance, a promise that the peace of paradise, which was known first within the mother womb, is not to be lost, that it supports the present and stands in the future as well as in the past, is Omega as well as Alpha, that though omnipotence may seem to be endangered by the threshold passages and life awakenings, protective power is always and ever present within the sanctuary of the heart, and even imminent within, or just behind, the unfamiliar features of the world. One has only to know and trust, and the ageless guardians will appear. Having responded to his own call, and continuing to follow courageously as the consequences unfold, the hero finds all the forces of the unconscious at his side. Mother Nature herself supports the mighty task, and insofar as the hero's act coincides with that for which his society itself is ready, he seems to ride on the great rhythm of the historical process. "I feel myself," said Napoleon at the opening of his Russian campaign, "driven towards an end that I do not know. As soon as I shall have reached it, as soon as I shall become unnecessary, an atom will suffice to shatter me. Till then, not all the forces of mankind can do anything against me." Not infrequently, the supernatural helper is masculine in form. In fairy lore, it may be some little fellow of the wood, some wizard, hermit, shepherd, or smith who appears to supply the amulets and advice that the hero will require. The higher mythologies develop the role in the great figure of the guide, the teacher, the ferryman, the conductor of souls to the afterworld. In classical myth, this is Hermes Mercury. In Egyptian, usually Thoth, the ibis god, the baboon god. In Christian, the Holy Ghost. Goethe presents the masculine guide in Faust as Mephistopheles. And not infrequently, the dangerous aspect of the mercurial figure is stressed, for he is the lurer of the innocent soul into realms of trial. In Dante's vision, the part is played by Virgil, who yields to Beatrice at the threshold of paradise. Protective and dangerous, motherly and fatherly at the same time, this supernatural principle of guardianship and direction unites in itself all the ambiguities of the unconscious, thus signifying the support of our conscious personality by that other larger system, but also the inscrutability of the guide that we are following, to the peril of all our rational ends.
The following dream supplies a vivid example of the fusion of opposites in the unconscious. I dreamed that I had gone into a street of brothels, and to one of the girls, as I entered, she changed into a man who was lying half-clothed on a sofa. He said, "It doesn't disturb you that I am now a man." The man looked old, and he had white sideburns. He reminded me of a certain chief forester who was a good friend of my father. All dreams, Dr. Stekel observes, have a bisexual tendency. Where the bisexuality cannot be perceived, it is hidden in the latent dream content.
The hero to whom such a helper appears is typically one who has responded to the call. The call, in fact, was the first announcement of the approach of this initiatory priest. But even to those who apparently have hardened their hearts, the supernatural guardian may appear. For, as we have seen, well able is Allah to save. And so it happened, as it were by chance, that in the ancient and deserted tower, where Kamar al-Zaman, the Persian prince, lay sleeping, there was an old Roman well, and this was inhabited by a jinnia of the seed of Iblis the Accursed, by name Maimuna, daughter of Al-Dimiryat, a renowned king of the jinn.
Compare Maimuna the jinn to the frog of the fairy tale. In pre-Mohammedan Arabia, the jinn, singular, masculine, jinni, feminine, jinnia, were haunting demons of the deserts and wilderness. Hairy and misformed, or else shaped as animals, ostriches, or serpents, they were very dangerous to unprotected persons. The Prophet Muhammad admitted the existence of these heathen spirits and incorporated them in the Muhammadan system, which recognizes three created intelligences under Allah: angels formed of light, jinn of subtle fire, and man of the dust of the earth. The Muhammadan jinn have the power of putting on any form they please, but not grosser than the essence of fire and smoke, and they can thus make themselves visible to mortals. There are three orders of jinn: flyers, walkers, and divers. Many are supposed to have accepted the true faith, and these are regarded as good. The rest are bad. The latter dwell and work in close association with the fallen angels, whose chief is Iblis, the despairer.
And as Kamar al-Zaman continued sleeping till the first third of the night, Maimuna came up out of the Roman well and made for the firmament, thinking to listen by stealth to the converse of the angels. But when she reached the mouth of the well and saw a light shining in the tower room, contrary to custom, she marveled, drew nigh, entered within the door, and beheld the couch spread, whereon was a human form with a wax candle burning at his head and the lantern at his feet. She folded her wings and stood by the bed, and drawing back the coverlid, discovered Kamar al-Zaman's face, and she was motionless for a full hour in admiration and wonderment. "Blessed be Allah," she exclaimed when she recovered, "the best of creators," for she was of the true believing jinn. Then she promised herself that she would do no hurt to Kamar al-Zaman, and became concerned lest, resting in this desert place, he should be slain by one of her relatives, the Merids. An ifrit, ifrita, is a powerful jinni, jinnia. The Merids are a particularly powerful and dangerous class of jinn. Bending over him, she kissed him between the eyes, and presently drew back the sheet over his face. And after a while she spread her wings and, soaring into the air, flew upwards till she drew near to the lowest of the heavens. Now, as chance or destiny would have it, the soaring ifrita, Maimuna, suddenly heard in her neighborhood the noisy flapping of wings. Directing herself by the sound, she found it coming from an ifrit called Danash. So she swooped down on him like a sparrow hawk. And when he was aware of her and knew her to be Maimuna, the daughter of the king of the jinn, he was sore afraid, and his side muscles quivered, and he implored her to forbear. But she challenged him to declare whence he should be coming at this hour of the night. He replied that he was returning from the islands of the inland sea in the parts of China, the realms of King Gayur, lord of the islands and the seas and the seven palaces. "There," said he, "I saw a daughter of his, than whom Allah hath made none fairer in her time." And he launched into great praise of the Princess Budur. Said he,
"She hath a nose like the edge of a burnished blade, and cheeks like purple wine or anemones blood red. Her lips as coral and cornelian shine, and the water of her mouth is sweeter than old wine. Its taste would quench hell's fiery pain. Her tongue is moved by wit of high degree and ready repartee. Her breast is seduction to all that see. Glory be to him who fashioned it and finished it, and joined thereto are two upper arms, smooth and rounded, even as saith of her the poet Al-Walahan, she has wrists which, did her bangles not contain, would run from out her sleeves in silvern rain."
The celebration of her beauty continued, and when Maimuna had heard it all, she remained silent in astonishment. Danash resumed and described the mighty king, her father, his treasures, and the seven palaces, as well as the history of the daughter's refusal to wed. "And I," said he, "O my lady, go to her every night and take my fill of feeding my sight on her face, and I kiss her between the eyes. Yet of my love to her, I do her no hurt." He desired Maimuna to fly back with him to China and look on the beauty, loveliness, stature, and perfection of proportion of the princess. "And after, if thou wilt," said he, "chastise me or enslave me, for it is thine to bid and to forbid." Maimuna was indignant that anyone should presume to celebrate any creature in the world after the glimpse she had just had of Kamar al-Zaman. "Faugh! Faugh!" she cried. She laughed at Danash and spat in his face. "Verily, this night I have seen a young man," said she, "whom, if thou saw, though but in a dream, thou wouldst be palsied with admiration, and spittle would flow from thy mouth." And she described his case. Danash expressed his disbelief that anyone could be more handsome than the Princess Budur, and Maimuna commanded him to come down with her and look. "I hear, and I obey," said Danash. And so they descended and alighted in the salon. Maimuna stationed Danash beside the bed and, putting out her hand, drew back the silken coverlet from Kamar al-Zaman's face, when it glittered and glistened and shimmered and shone like the rising sun. She gazed at him for a moment, then, turning sharply round upon Danash, said, "Look, O accursed, and be not the basest of madmen. I am a maid, yet my heart he hath waylaid." "By Allah, O my lady, thou art excusable," declared Danash. "But there is yet another thing to be considered, and that is that the estate female differeth from the male. By Allah's might, this thy beloved is the likest of all created things to my mistress in beauty and loveliness and grace and perfection, and it is as though they were both cast alike in the mold of seemlihead." The light became darkness in Maimuna's sight when she heard those words, and she dealt Danash with her wing so fierce a buffet on the head as well nigh made an end of him. "I conjure thee," she commanded, "by the light of my love's glorious countenance, go at once, O accursed, and bring hither thy mistress, whom thou lovest so fondly and foolishly, and return in haste that we may lay the twain together, and look at them both as they lie asleep side by side. So shall it appear to us which be the goodlier and more beautiful of the two." And so, incidentally to something going on in a zone of which he was entirely unconscious, the destiny of the life-reluctant Kamar al-Zaman began to fulfill itself, without the cooperation of his conscious will.